Today's guest is a Lieutenant Colonel with the Nevada Air National Guard and former combat pilot. Originally from Tampa, Florida, after graduating high school, he went on to attend the United States Air Force Academy. After graduating with degrees in both geospatial science and Spanish, he went on to record well over 1,500 hours as a combat-proven fighter pilot with multiple deployments to the Middle East in both the F-15 and the F-22. He finished his active duty career serving as the F-22 demonstration team commander and pilot. With multiple air shows under his belt, both here in the U.S. and abroad, including a flyover at the 2022 Super Bowl. Please join me in welcoming Lieutenant Colonel Joshua Cabo Gunderson to the podcast.
I heard a very interesting story you told on a different podcast, which was your scariest experience while being in an airplane. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. It definitely, you know, it was one of those moments where afterwards you reflect on how important life is and how, you know, small little things can change and it can either be done or you have a new lease on life. Right. And you know, for me, at least it was in Alaska, we're coming to land and we had, you know, some stuff happen that led to a pretty catastrophic, failure of a component on an airplane, an F-22. And as a result, like I basically ended up, you know, working the problem, but it all happened very quickly. And I was within feet of not being here.
Man, and,
you know, I reflect on that and I think about how important training and preparation, all those things go into everything we do in life. I had amazing instructors, amazing mentors and teachers on the flying side and professionally and personally, and all the repetitions you put in when nobody's watching, all the stuff you do, you practice and you build these skill sets and you keep working at it until it's perfect. All those things become second nature. So when stress happens, when pressure happens,
it's almost like instinct.
Yeah. You have to rely upon that training. So if you don't put in the work, you know, beforehand, you know, your performance really falls down to your level of preparation. And if it wasn't good, then you're not going to do well. And, you know, I've had a lot of time, especially after that mishap, to really reflect on that whole scenario. And I'm so thankful that I was the person that happened to, because I had amazing mentors, amazing teachers, and I had done the work. So when that tough situation happened and I was, you know, feet away from not being here anymore, I was able to respond the way I did. And I'm also not under any kind of illusion that I'm that great of a pilot. You know, there were so many things that happened outside of my control that also contributed to successfully kind of navigating that tough challenge. So people have different beliefs, whether it's, you know, faith or spirituality, et cetera. And, I definitely believe that there are moments in our life that happen that we may or may not control, and we're tested in some way.
Absolutely.
And when you finish that test, you have a perspective on life that you're like, okay, I don't want to waste any more time. I've been given this opportunity to keep doing things that are important. And that's really the lesson that, you know, happened for me after that experience where, you know, out of my control, something happened and I had to navigate it, and I'm just thankful that I have the opportunity, like a lease on life, where I can continue to contribute. And after that incident that happened in 2018 in October, I was fortunate enough to go on and fly as the airshow pilot for the Air Force in the F-22. Yeah. And what was amazing about that experience was I got to go share, you know, not that specific experience, but I got to share my background, my path to joining the Air Force, path to flying airplanes that were amazing with thousands and thousands and thousands of young folks across the country and the globe. Funny story, we actually did an air show in Santiago, Chile, and most of my family's originally from Cuba. My first language was Spanish growing up. And I had two team members on the team at the time from Puerto Rico. So we take these two, you know, airplanes that are probably $300 million total. We have a team of people. We land in Santiago, and when we get out of the airplanes, we're just talking to the people in Spanish, and they're like, where did you guys come from? Did you guys like, come from America?
Like aliens, you know? Right? Yeah.
You know, it was really funny though. And, you know, so I got to share my experience, the team's experience, what led them and how, you know, what experiences shaped their life in a really meaningful way. And that's one thing that has happened after that mishap that I'm very thankful that I had the opportunity to do that, because it's been able to help impact a lot of people. I have a lot of, you know, I get a lot of messages on social media, people that I talk to 4 or 5 years ago. And they're like, now I'm in college, now I'm flying airplanes, I'm in the Air Force. And, you know, and it only took 15, 20 minute conversation or a simple text message response. And, you know, that I know I realized that did not change, you know, on a big scale, their direction in life, but it had small impact in them. And
well, I think in a lot of ways, there's a lot of parallels between what you went through in that airplane versus the impact that you're making with them. All it takes is that split second event to make a change that where things can go for the positive or for the negative. But pivoting back a little bit, I guess, was it difficult to get into an airplane again after that happened?
So the, you know, there are legal things we have to do after that happens. You know, if you have a mishap with an airplane, you know, they do all the drug testing, make sure that there's nothing weird, no funny business happening.
It wasn't
No, and everything's good, you know, everything was good. And they go back and see, they review all the footage, review all the test data, and they determine like, hey, did you cause this or did it happen? It just happened.
Yeah.
And once they made that determination, like, hey, you're clear. Then I was able to fly about a week later. I've wanted to fly airplanes since I was a little kid. I don't remember a time where I didn't want to fly airplanes, and specifically wanted to fly fighter jets in the military. So for me, getting back in an airplane after that happened, you know, it was a little bit challenging, but I'm just of the mindset that the only way that fear goes away is if you stare it right in the eyes.
Absolutely.
You have to stare it down and you have to get back on the horse and ride again. And to me, it was important that I got back in the airplane as soon as I could, so I didn't have more time to think about it, you know. When bad things
really mess with you, I feel like over time, if you might have waited like a month, that would have like really like kind of stopped you from.
Yeah, maybe, you know, it just our mind plays tricks on us, you know, and our mind allows us to go down these paths, and we like sometimes have negative self-talk and negative feelings and thoughts and emotions about something negative that happened in our life. And at least for me, it was really important I got back in the airplane as soon as possible. And, you know, I've always felt comfortable in airplanes. Mm-hmm. It always brings me to peace. It's like, I explained to my mom, it's like driving a car. You know, I get in the car and I go to work, and using the airplane, you know, I fly to work, I do my work, and then I fly back home.
That's wild, commuter. Though, because
it's a wild commute. Thinking, yeah.
I'm like, like I click all these buttons. And after that, I'm like, all right, just like driving. I'm like, no. Yeah.
The scary part is, you know, sometimes it's happened to me. I don't know. I guess I hope it doesn't happen, I guess, when flying an airplane. But sometimes you just are so used to that daily commute, you almost go in autopilot, which could be very dangerous if it happens in an airplane.
It could be absolutely dangerous in an airplane. And complacency is one of the things that the FAA and every pilot I know talks about as really important, because it's easy to get in the routine and miss things, you know, and that's why, at least in aviation, we're very focused on checklists. You know, you can be distracted by a thousand other things. And you always, you know, you do your steps and you always go back to the checklist and review and make sure that I got everything done.
Yeah.
Because it's so easy to get distracted. And I've been there. Every other pilot has been there. Even in our daily lives, not in aviation, you're there where you get distracted by something, and you forget something important. So we have a very good culture in terms of checklist discipline to make sure that when things go weird, we revert back to that to make sure we don't miss anything.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. 60% of y'all watching this are still not subscribed, man. Do us a favor, tap that subscribe button. Now back to the episode.
Flying in an air show, what's the difference between the jets at air shows and jets that are like combat ready? Is it a very big difference?
There are some differences, and depends on the team. So we have, you know, the amazing U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds here in Las Vegas, Nevada, at Nellis Air Force Base, and have amazing friends on the team. They do a phenomenal job showcasing what the airplanes can do and teamwork that goes into putting these air shows on. Like, it's not just the pilots, you know. We are the most important person on the team, at least for the F-22 demonstration, for 20 to 30 minutes, and then for the Thunderbirds, probably 45 minutes. And then when we're done being the most important person on the team for that period of time, we hand it back to the most amazing maintainers that work on the airplanes, get them serviced, get them ready to go. And then public affairs is taking the footage and putting out marketing material for the Air Force, you know? So it's an amazing team, and the Thunderbirds do an incredible job. The Thunderbirds, like the Blue Angels, they have very special airplanes that are modified for air shows, specifically to include smoke machines, you know, so they fly and have smoke and all that stuff. So they modify the airplanes heavily for those shows because they're meant for air shows. Other airplanes, depending on what it is, modify the airplane slightly. I will say the F-22, out of all the airplanes in the U.S. Air Force, we fly a completely unmodified airplane.
Wow.
So every airplane you see at an air show that's an F-22, it is a combat representation of what that airplane can do. So the only thing we're missing at shows, obviously, is the bombs, missiles, and bullets. We can't carry those. And we carry all those internally. So, and I say that because, and to get a little more context to the listeners, when you start hanging missiles and bombs off of airplanes, it adds drag, which decreases your performance. Imagine, you know, you have a car that's really a high performing car, and then you put like, you know, you strap like a refrigerator to the top, right? All the drag slows you down, and the weight slows you down, all those things. The F-22 carries everything inside the airplane. So we don't really pay a penalty for drag when it comes to carrying weapons. So realistically, aside from those weapons that don't really impact our performance, the airplane is completely unmodified for air shows.
Awesome. And what was it like flying in your first air show?
It was awesome. And it was actually, it was a really funny story. So I started in 2020 for my first season. My first air show was in Singapore, and it was in February of 2020. So we all know there was some big world event that happened in 2020.
Yeah.
They kind of changed things.
Absolutely.
We get on the airplane, flying to Singapore. COVID was not a thing in America in February of 2020. At least it wasn't a widespread thing that people were aware of. I land in Singapore, and I get an email on my work phone. And the email said, you know, I was asking the question, when are you guys landing in Singapore? This COVID thing seems like it's a real thing, and it may be a big deal, and you have to stay back here in the States if it's, you know, whatever. But I just landed in Singapore with the team, and I responded. I said, hey, we're in Singapore already. And they're like, well, all right, have a good time, you know?
and too late to do anything about it now.
Yeah, exactly. And it was, I mean, honestly, it was a really surreal experience because obviously in Asia, COVID was a big thing. The Singapore air show is a really massive event, and a lot of big sponsors like Boeing, Airbus, you know, really decreased their footprint and how many people were going to go to this air show. But we still were there with the F-22s, and what was cool about it was, one, it's a beautiful location. It's, you know, the show is over the water. Water's like crystal blue, beautiful backdrop. And what else was really cool was that the Chinese Air Force actually sent their Thunderbird equivalent to that air show as well. So I'm flying my first air show internationally in Singapore, representing the United States of America with the F-22, and the Chinese Air Force is there representing China, obviously. And we have this great photo of the F-22 doing some cool tricks and all of the Chinese generals and leadership just with their phones out staring like amazed at what this airplane's doing, you know?
Like, dang, they really
You know, it's just like, we're just slam dunking on them. And it was like, it was coolest an amazing, thing, like patriotic, awesome feeling.
It's like the Olympics.
It was super cool. Yeah super cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And what's been your favorite air show to fly in?
There were tons of amazing ones. I would say the most important one to me and the one I enjoyed the most was in my hometown in Tampa, Florida. I left home when I was 17. I went to the Air Force Academy for undergraduate school, went to pilot training, lived overseas, lived in Spain, Japan, Alaska, Oregon, Texas, you know, lived all over. But a lot of my friends and family had never seen me fly an airplane. And so that was cool, right? I had a lot of friends and family come out there and see what I've been doing for the last 20 years of my life. So it was cool, it was special and cool to share that time with them. And also, you know, my parents got divorced when I was two. My mom was, you know, my family was, you know, very supportive. For a long time, they wanted me to play baseball. You know, my family's originally from Cuba. My uncle played baseball professionally, and I looked very similar to him. So like, oh, you got to play baseball, you know?
I want to fly airplanes.
Yeah, I was like, I want to fly airplanes. And my mom was incredibly supportive, and she took me to air shows every year that they had an air show at MacDill, which is the Air Force Base there in Tampa, Florida. And when I was 12, I met the demo pilot who was flying the F-15 at the time. He was gracious enough to, after the show, to come talk to me, to take a picture and this whole thing, right? And to kind of make this story a little shorter, 12 years later, I run into him again. He was one of my instructors in the F-15 when I went to school for the F-15. And then, you know, we basically found out that we're from the same hometown, went to rival high schools, had all these parallels in our lives, which was crazy.
Insane.
And we've kept in touch. He's been an amazing friend and mentor for me. So to go back to that show where my friends and family are at, where I had this amazing experience, you know, meeting the demo pilot as a 12-year-old kid, and now I'm the person doing that at that show, standing on the same ground, flying in the same airspace. And he actually was there with his family as well, which is really cool, to kind of see that go full circle.
See the whole tie.
I know. Yeah. Cause I met him when I was 12. I meet him 12 years later after I, you know, finished high school, gone to the Air Force Academy for school, gone to pilot training, competed to get an F-15, was successful, got an F-15, earned that, and then went to F-15 school. See him there as one of my instructors. I'm like, wow, that was full circle, right?
Yeah, like the chances of that happening, I feel, is just like, But I feel like the world ends up making that happen just because,
yeah,
like, you're probably, like, inspiring the next generation to do the same that you did.
And it's such an important job. So, you know, I thought at that time it had gone full circle. I'm like, that was cool. Mm-hmm. And then to get the demonstration team job, I was like, well, that's cool. It's like another like revolution around the circle, you know, and then him being at that show in my hometown with family and friends and his family there watching, that was like another turn around the circle, you know. Super cool. And yeah, you bet. The air show world is 100%. I mean, there's obviously recruiting. We're trying to get people to join the service and we want amazing folks to serve. And I can't say how important that is. I'm very thankful that this country gave my family an opportunity to succeed, leaving a country that, you know, is communist, is still communist, and literally took away everything from them. My grandfather had his career, had his business, took away everything to come here for an opportunity. They didn't speak the language, you know, had contacts over here, but really no money, no, you know, language abilities, no connections here in America. And it gave them an opportunity to do really well. And, so I'm really passionate about people serving this country. And I'm very passionate about my service of this, you know, to this country, because I just want to say thank you to what this, you know, what this country's opportunity are given in terms of opportunities for my family. So I think service is important. Recruiting is important, but what you touched on, inspiring people is such an important role. And even as somebody who's been flying air shows and flying jets, I look at airplanes, see them fly, and I still get excited. And when you see a little kid that's, you know, 5, 6, 7, 10 years old, 12 years old, like I was, and you see them with a huge smile on their face and like the stars in their eyes, they're excited. You can't put a price on that, you know? And unfortunately, we live in a world that we want results right away. We're expecting information right away. We text and, you know, the text goes from me to you and it's, you got it right away. And then you respond to me and whatever. And when you're inspiring people to pursue their goals, whether it's flying airplanes or not, that journey takes a long time.
Right.
It may take a young kid in an air show 12 years before they're now flying airplanes and serving the country. So that investment you make doesn't actually, you don't see the return on investment for 12 years. It's really hard to quantify. It's really hard to say, hey, our air show pilots did this and they met these metrics and they inspired however many people, because we don't really see the reward in some cases for over a decade. But nonetheless, it's one of the most important things that we do is to really get the American public behind the military, supporting it. And we can show that we are invested in them and want the American public to succeed and do well.
Definitely. It's like, there's an old saying, I'm going to butcher it, but it's kind of like it goes something like, the sign of a great man is the man that plants a seed that he's never going to sit, or that is going to grow a tree he's never going to sit under the shade of, or something like that.
Yeah. No, and it's like paraphrased in so many ways. And I think it's so important, you know, you can have goals that you reach in a week, in 2 weeks, in a month, whatever it is. I think the real big goals, real big dreams people have don't happen overnight.
Of course.
It takes a long time and it takes dedication over a long period of time. That consistency is what really determines if somebody is successful or not. You know, are you willing to put in the time and effort when it sucks, when you're tired? And you have all these other things going on, are you willing to still put in the effort?
Absolutely.
Can you speak on some of those moments you had? Because like you said, it's a long journey, right?
Yeah.
It's not something that you just arrived to overnight.
Yep.
What were some moments throughout your journey that you hit where you saw some adversity or some challenges and you're like, am I maybe like fit for this? Am I able to
power through?
Follow through?
Yeah. You know, I think one of the things I would say is like, if you, one, take the time to find out what you really want to do. And I think when you figure that out, it's so powerful. It's like the most powerful, you know, drug booster, whatever you can think of, because it fuels your desire to pursue it. If it's not a meaningful goal, you're going to find every excuse and you're going to give in to those excuses to not achieve the end state. If the goal is meaningful and powerful enough for you that it drives you to succeed, no matter what hurdle, no matter what obstacle happens, like you're going to still get past it, you know? And I would say along the way, there's so many roadblocks and hurdles and life things that happened. You know, going to school, one, applying to the Air Force Academy or West Point or the Naval Academy is really challenging. And there's a lot of stuff that goes into that process. I mean, it's a multi-year application process. So that, right, you have to do consistently well in academics and sports and all those things over a long period of time, which is, you know, it's a commitment to those events. But, you know, in the larger scale, like there's a longer term goal that these are going to lead to. And going to school, the academy is challenging. You're doing 18 to 21 credit hours a semester. You're doing sports. You're doing all these other things. You're doing the military stuff. You know, it's just it's an overwhelming 4-year period where you're doing a lot of stuff. So that was challenging for sure. And then in pilot training, you know, my mom was a single parent, working multiple jobs to raise my brother and I, and we didn't have the means to learn how to fly. Like she knew I wanted to fly. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the money to like put me through flying lessons. And for any young folks that are interested in aviation that want to do that, and maybe in the same circumstances, I would say that right now there are amazing scholarships and grants out there now to help people learn how to fly. So there, you know, that wasn't the case when I was growing up, but there's been a big shift, and people are really focused on giving out scholarships and grants for people to learn how to fly airplanes. So get on the internet, look those things up. There are a lot of amazing opportunities to give you those skills or give you the opportunity with funds to go learn how to fly airplanes. But for me, like, you know, it's a big leap of faith, right? Like, I've known I want to fly airplanes my entire life. I've never flown airplanes, so I could hate it. I could not be good at it.
Yeah.
You know, I've put all my eggs in this one basket and said, like, I'm going to be a fighter pilot. And like I said, I didn't know I was going to get it. I didn't know if I was going to like it. I didn't know any of those things. When I started flying, I absolutely fell in love with it. And like I mentioned earlier, it feels natural. It feels like home to me.
Did it feel like you thought it was going to feel, or was it something like completely different? That obviously you still liked it, but was it like you imagined it to be?
I think the first, you know, we do something fun and exciting the first couple of times. Yeah. It's fun and exciting, right? And it's just amazing. And then eventually, you know, like everything you do, whether you're a professional athlete or, you know, business or entertainment or politics or whatever you're in, eventually becomes work. You know, there are still fun moments, but it becomes work. And I think what I found really important there was the job is really important, and people's lives depended on my ability and my team's ability to execute our job really well. So I found deep meaning and deep purpose in that. And that's what kept me going and working really hard, even past the excitement phase. There was one moment though that stands out, and you know, all of us go through life and we have these like images in our brain that will be like burned in there forever. And I was at F-15 school, and it was one of my third like dogfighting flights that I'd done in the jet. So I was very, very inexperienced in the airplane. And the person that was my instructor for that flight, you know, in the F-15, they're single seat airplanes. You're so right. You're flying your own airplane, yeah. And the instructor that's teaching you is in the other airplane. You're fighting him. And it so happened
that
to be.
Sounds, I'm sorry. That just sounds like some like old like Asian movie where you see like the
like a kung fu movie. Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah. So you know, like you know, he's in his airplane, and the sun was going down. We're in Oregon. The sun's going down, and we get into this. It's basically a fight, a dogfight, effectively. And this is a phase called a tree, where you basically like both airplanes are very, very slow, and you're trying to push the other guy out in front of you. You know, so you get an advantage. Mm. You can get behind the other guy and be able to use your weapons, etc. And this image in my brain is burned in there so deeply. Here's the most experienced F-15 pilot in the country flying airplanes right now. And I'm probably the least experienced F-15 guy in the country flying airplanes right now, you know, and sun's going down. His afterburners are lit. So you have these two great big like orange and yellow flames that are sticking out of the back of his airplane. And we're like, our nose is super high. We're very slow. And we're like kind of jousting for position here. And I just remember seeing that. I'm like, this is wild. Insane. You know, all this work, the school, high school, Air Force Academy, pilot training, which is over a year long, other programs, you know, have gotten me to this place where I'm flying this $50 million airplane as a 24-year-old against this guy who's like in his mid-40s, has been flying this airplane for 2 decades plus. And it was just this cool, cool experience that I will never forget until I die. How amazing it was to see that. And just kind of, it was like it was a moment where I realized like all this effort got me here. And I'm so proud to be here and so happy to be here that I get to learn from people like that who've been doing this for 20 plus years and get their, you know, gain from their experience and lessons. It was just a very, very pivotal moment for me.
That's an incredible story, man. I could just imagine like picturing it like with the sun going down.
It was just so amazing, good, man.
I want you to get engaged, all right? So please comment down below right now. Tell us what your favorite moment is. All right, back to the episode.
Speaking about the pride of feeling like you being in that moment after everything that you had been through, you've been all over the world, lived in a bunch of different places. In terms of like world ranking, obviously America, we're very patriotic, I would say more than a lot of places, mm-hmm. but do you also see that in a lot of other countries to the same level that we see it here? Or is it like a little bit different? Are people kind of indifferent about it?
You know, much like America, you know, there are parts of America that are less patriotic than others. Mm-hmm. I mean, I go to Texas a lot for work, and I mean, you meet Texans and they're so proud they're Texan, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so proud of America, and some places are just less likely, you know, and I think across the globe, it's probably very similar. I think as a country though, I'd say America is probably the most patriotic place I've visited, you know, like they're just very proud of America. And I think, you know, you ask yourself, like, where does that come from? I think America is still the only place that I've visited across the globe where we are trying this experiment. Nowhere else is doing it. We are trying to have a country that is a republic that's, you know, that allows people the opportunity to elevate their life in a meaningful way through hard work. And we don't care where you're from. We don't care what your background is. We don't care what you believe in terms of faith. We don't care who you love. We don't care about any of those things. We want you, we want the value and your values, your work ethic to determine, you know, where your path is in life. You know, and sometimes we see things in the news and it's kind of conflicting where people are just like back and forth and talking about race and religion, et cetera. I'm like, guys, MLK figured this out back in the 60s and he was 100% right. 100% right. We should judge people on the content of their character, not the color of their skin. And to my knowledge, like, America is still the only place that is the land of opportunity that you can literally show up here with nothing and make this amazing life for yourself. I have a really good friend of mine who owns a tech company, moved here from India with his wife, two little girls, and he has absolutely crushed it because he's an amazing human being, amazing work ethic, and very intelligent.
Or even stories like yours, like for example, your family moving here, coming from nothing, your mom struggling to raise you and your brother, yeah. and like look what you made out of yourself, you know, becoming.
And the goal is, you know, you keep
of course,
doing
yeah.
right. Like, you know, I want my son to grow up and I want him to do way better than me.
Absolutely.
I want to look back and be like, man, I wish I wasn't just slacker, dude. Like little boy is doing better than me. You know, that's what you want, that you want to make every generation better and better. But yeah, I just, you know, and obviously I'm biased because I was born in America and I served in the military. Yeah. But I really do think America still is like the beacon of hope in terms of opportunity. And, you know, I there's obviously like an emotional aspect where I feel that way, but you look at the borders, right? And like people are still trying to get here.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
They're still trying and they're leaving behind all this stuff in their life and their family and all these things and taking a risk on America to provide an opportunity for them to succeed, make their life better.
Absolutely.
Why do you think
we're losing some of that identity though? Because for as many people that are trying to get here and escape, what really most people in this country haven't seen, the struggles that a lot of people go through to get here, right? There's a reason people are trying to come here. Then we have a lot of people that are born here and just take it all for granted and just will bash everything about America given any opportunity. What do you think? What do you think has been leading to that?
You know, to put it simply, I think it's comfort. Our country has been a safe place where you can raise your family and pursue your career ambitions and all these things. And I think most people that haven't traveled outside the country, haven't traveled to places where it is truly tough to live, they don't understand how majority of the world is. You know, we have this amazing environment where we can raise our families in relative safety and all those things. And you can do whatever you want to do. Like if you want to go watch a baseball game, you want to watch a Golden Knights game, like go watch a Golden Knights game.
Right.
Nobody's stopping you. Are you the richest person in town or the poorest person in town? Like if you have the ability to get to a game, like nobody's going to stop you. Right. If you want to start a business, start a business. Nobody's stopping you. You know, and in other countries, like you don't have that opportunity or the ability to just get on a podcast and say what you think.
Yeah.
That's true.
You're like, hey, I believe this or I believe that. You know, I remember hearing stories from my family and my grandparents that they would have informants on every street corner. So if you said anything against the government,
bye-bye.
Nobody saw you tomorrow.
Yeah.
Like you're just not there anymore. Nobody knows where you went. I mean, they know where you went, but you're not coming back.
Someone took you.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, I just think that the fact that we as a country still are embracing the idea of we want a diverse population of people. And when I say diversity, people view the word diversity in a very narrow scope sometimes. And they're like, it's race. And you're like, well, no. That's like one aspect, right? Yeah. Diversity is race, your family background, your upbringing, your culture, your faith. Like, there's so many elements of diversity. And I think it's still the only place that we truly embrace all those and want, we want that diversity of thought. And I think when I think about diversity, I immediately go to like diversity of thought.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's what really matters to me and what makes people unique and special is the way they think about problems, the way they think about situations and the way they think about relationships and all those things. So to me, that's super important. And I'm just proud to be American. I'm super appreciative that my grandparents had the courage to move here and leave everything behind. You know, they waited almost 7 years to come over here legally. And then before they came over here, they took my grandfather's company away from him. They took all the stuff, you know, from my family before they came here with nothing. So the courage that he had when he was 33 and my grandmother come over here with three young kids and leave everything behind on this like bet that America is the place that they're going to be able to make a future. I'm just like, I'm very proud of that. Very proud of them. And proud of all the folks that take that risk to come here and start a life. And ultimately our country is a richer country culturally because of that.
Absolutely.
I think the military is a really funny place, because we have people from all backgrounds, all cultures, everything. Yeah. You know, you can go into like on the base and like the lodging, the barracks, whatever, and you can have, you know, people eating like Indian food, listening to rap music, wearing cowboy hats, and you're like, like, where else does that happen?
Right.
Right. Yeah. Where else does that happen?
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's such a cool thing. Yeah. It's such a cool thing. So yeah, I'm just very, very happy to be here.
Have you been back to Cuba?
I've actually never been to Cuba for a couple of reasons. One, I legally can't go because my ties to the military still. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And two, you know, and I'm, you know, I understand people's perspective if they want to go to Cuba and visit. And I want nothing more than to go and see where my family grew up in Cuba. But at the same time, I refuse to give that government a cent of my money.
Yeah.
You know, because we know that money is not going to the people, it's going to the government. And I just refuse to give them, like, out of principle, I refuse to give them a cent of my money.
Yeah.
It's a funny story. My grandfather actually, he was probably the most American person of, like, one of the most American people I've met in my life. Until he died, he like refused to drink vodka.
What?
He was like, it's a Russian communist drink.
Wow.
Not drink. I'm like, this is from Sweden. He was like, I don't care.
On your ground.
You know, yeah. And he would only make, he was off principle. You know, yeah, he was a mechanic for over 50 years of his life, and he only bought Made in America tools, like Craftsman, and that was it.
Craftsman, yeah.
So it's just, it's funny, right? And I grew up around that, and that's where I learned from. He was a really influential person in my life. Yeah, I just like, I don't know. Like, so those are the reasons why I haven't gone back to Cuba, but I really hope that it changes, over the next, you know, over my lifetime. So I can go and see, sure. I'll tell you what's really fun about Vegas though. I didn't know this, but apparently like Vegas is like one of the top three, populations of Cuban immigrants,
really?
In the country. You have like Miami, you have Houston. And you have Vegas.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I wouldn't think it would be in the top three.
Yeah,
that's, I would think it was like, know, all Florida. It may be like top five. I don't know, but it's really high. Like, somebody's gonna quote me on that and be like, "Oh, he's wrong."
Actually, if you look,
it's number six. Yeah. You know? But it's really high. And whenever I take an Uber, like if I ever get an Uber Black, I would say 99 times out of 100, the driver is from Cuba.
Not gonna lie, now that you said that, I do remember having a few Cuban Uber drivers.
It's crazy,
yeah,
right?
It's a high chance, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it's crazy though, because I talk to them and like all of them have the same view. They're all love America and love freedom, love democracy, love, you know, the opportunities in this country. And it's just like overwhelming. And I don't even prompt it. You know, people are very like talkative and whatever else. And I don't even like prompt that discussion. They just go into it.
They have to say it. Like, you know, they got to get it out.
It's like the people that do CrossFit. Yeah. I just got to get it out.
My wrist wraps, knee wraps, knee high socks, all the good stuff, the CrossFit. It's just like, it's funny. Like they love America. And I've met so many immigrants from other countries who love America so much more than some people that were born here. It's just crazy.
I know. Yeah. It's insane. But okay. What does it feel like? Is there any comparison in the day-to-day life of what it feels like to be in an airplane? Or can you just not have that unless you're like in a simulator or actually in an airplane, in a fighter jet?
Yeah, you know, kind of talking through the day-to-day life, what I love about flying jets, you know, when I was doing it full-time in the Air Force, was that every day truly is different.
Hmm.
You could do the same mission type every day, and every engagement, everything is, you know, there's some small difference in details and it changes. So I like the difference that every day brought. And you know, we all have probably seen Top Gun, Top Gun 2, and like you see all this stuff, and it's Hollywood, right? Like they, and over the way, shout out to all the people that made that movie, because they did an amazing job. Like Kevin LaRosa and his team that did all the aerial photography and cinematography, like phenomenal work. There were some previous Blue Angels that were actually flying the airplanes, and they just did an awesome job. And some people were like, oh, this is super hokey and terrible and whatever. And I'm like, guys, it's Hollywood.
Yeah.
It's a movie.
Yeah.
You know, I thought they did a phenomenal job creating a sequel. That was great. But unlike the movies, the vast majority of our time as fighter pilots is spent in a room with no windows, and we're studying, we're planning, you know, there were missions that I planned for months, and obviously I'm still flying and doing other things as well, mm-hmm. but like there is a planning process that could take months for one mission.
Dang.
And all the studying that goes into it, right? We have new hardware, new software, and we upgrade the jet all the time. And are you staying on top of that? Do you know what the capabilities are? Do you know how to use them? The adversary, the enemy aircraft are doing the same thing. So how well do you know their airplanes, their surface-to-air missiles, their all these things? Like there are so many things to stay on top of. So it's a very intensive, like if, I think if a fighter pilot told you they weren't a nerd, they'd be lying to you because we're all nerds. Like we all have to be nerds.
You gotta be a nerd to be good at something. I feel like you can't just be like, oh, I'm just cool. It's like,
you can't be nonchalant about it. Yeah.
So, you know, you spend a lot of time studying, planning, rehearsing in your brain, rehearsing with your team, before any flight. And you know, like I said, it could be a 25-minute, like you could fly for an hour, do 25 minutes of like your actual mission and spend days planning that.
And what do you mean by rehearsal? Do you guys like how do you guys do that rehearsal?
So a lot of times what we'll do is, you know, we'll have maps on the board. We'll draw, just like constantly draw scenarios of, okay, if this happens, then we're going to do this. And we kind of break things down into contracts, and you think about contracts of like legal documents. Mm-hmm. Like I buy a house as a contract. You know, do whatever. I get married as a contract. You know, we think about contracts in a way that's delegating authority to other people. So when I say contract, it's like there has to be an event or a time that's going to trigger some action that I want. Mm. I may be busy flying my airplane, doing something else over here. If that thing happens and I forget to recognize it, I need to empower you to do your job in accordance with the game plan that I gave you. Right. So we figure out, okay, what trigger event happens? How do I communicate that? How do I, you know, make sure that people understand what they're responsible for, what they have authority to do, and then what do I actually want them to do? So we go through these scenarios where we plan out, you know, okay, here's our general plan. We go through how this plan is going to look. And then after that, we probably spend 2/3 of the time contingency planning. So we try to figure out if things don't go our way, like how are we going to solve this? And same thing, like, okay, if we see this thing happen, how are we going to adjust our forces to solve that problem? And this is all happening in like seconds, right? So we have to figure out all those things before we even go to the airplane. Like we know what the plan is before we go to the airplane. Because if we're waiting to figure out game plans while we're actually flying, it's going to be too late and we're going to lose. So we go through probably 2/3 of our time is spent on contingency planning and figuring out how do we solve things that don't go our way. And we use those contracts to give a very clear framework of, okay, if this happens, you know, here's what we're going to say. Here's who has the authority. Here's what we're going to have. This is what's going to happen. And then we kind of rehearse that over and over again. And we kind of talk through chronologically from start to finish, like, how is this fight or this thing going to happen? And how are we going to flex to things if it doesn't go our way?
I have a question.
Yeah. That's what we're here for.
Not saying that you would or that anybody else would, but theoretically, while you're flying a jet, could you listen to music?
Yeah, you can absolutely listen to music if you wanted to. Not that it's legal or recommended or any of those things. But yeah, I mean, I think Bose actually, there's some like splitter device. We have ear molds that go in our ear that they, you know, mold to your ear that connect to the radio so you can listen and talk through that. And there's like somebody that figured out how to split a Bose, like whatever it was so you could hear like music in one ear. And then, so I know those exist. I never did. I never used them.
Let's just say that you did. We're not saying you did. Let's say you did, right? What would be that one song you would put on?
Yeah, that's a great question.
T Team America. Are you kidding me? I guess it would depend on the scenario. Are you just like cruising? Do you want to listen to some smooth jazz? I don't know. Do you want to listen to some like old school Dre? I don't know. Like, it depends on the scenario.
That's it.
And that was one really fun thing about the air show world, right? So we did the air shows and there's a bunch of cool maneuvers and stuff. To me, like, I grew up playing music. I like design. I like music. I like, you know, putting on a show that people remember. And for me, like, the, you know, people go to an air show and they see a bunch of airplanes flying and it's really cool. And that's awesome. I wanted people to walk away and be like, the show was amazing. But the one time when the F-22 did that one thing and the beat dropped in the song and it was all synchronized, like, I will never forget that. Like, that image I talked about earlier with, like, sunset and everything, I want them to walk away with that image, you know? So for me, it was important that it wasn't just me flying an airplane. We have a team of amazing people, maintenance guys, public affairs guys, people that take care of the flying gear, all that stuff. And they do announcing, they do music, all those things. So I brought them in to the plan, right? We created a plan that allowed us to use music to create the effect we wanted. And we timed everything. So every single maneuver was timed down to the second. And we knew that, for example, the dedication pass, 16 seconds. So like, when I want to do that pass, when they hit play on the song, in 16 seconds, the chorus is hitting. So I better be at the place doing the thing at the right time.
Can you give an example of one of those songs that you guys use?
It's a great question. And actually, my favorite maneuver, actually, the entire air show was the dedication pass. And that maneuver was simply to say thank you to the men and women who've served and paid the ultimate price and haven't come back from conflict. And more importantly, their families who are still here paying that, you know, or I guess with that burden of like loss.
Of course.
So it's not a complicated maneuver. It was a very low, fast turn where basically just like, if I'm the crowd, like, I'm just going to arc in front of the crowd really low, really fast. And there's like a bunch of vapor on the jet. It's really cool. So we played a song and this was the only song. So I'll talk about more about the song stuff here in a second, but it was the only song in 3 years we never changed. We changed every other song multiple times, even weekend to weekend. But a song called, They Were There by Granger Smith. He's a friend of mine, country music artist in Texas. And, his grandfather was a pilot in World War II. He did this documentary. It was about 55 minutes long and he went out to Big Bend National Park in West Texas. And it's beautiful. And he did it for 5 days. He hiked around, you know, and told the story of five Gold Star families. And a Gold Star family is a family that has lost a service member. So each of those 5 days, he told a different story of a different Gold Star family member. And he wrote some songs that tied into that whole narrative. And They Were There is one of those songs. It was actually the title track to the album he wrote for the documentary. And it really talks about sacrifice and like loss and the sacrifice the military members pay sometimes in service to our nation. The lyrics of the song are amazing. Granger is an amazing human being. And for me, that song was really powerful. And for that specific maneuver, the dedication pass to those men and women, I couldn't find anything more suitable than that song. And honestly, if we missed other songs by like a second or two and it was just a little bit off, I really didn't get upset until like we messed that song up. And I was like, that's the most important song. The most important thing we're doing this entire show is to say thank you to the families who are still dealing with that burden of sacrifice. And that was the one song that we just like, I was like, we have to get this right every time. And the other songs that we did was, once again, I like design, I like music, I like entertainment in a way that connects with audiences. Since we knew that every maneuver had a specific timing to it, 16 seconds, 26 seconds, whatever, you now know, okay, I have 26 seconds. So now I can take a song and I can get rid of this song and I can bring in a new song and cut it to where like the chorus hits 26 seconds or the beat drops or whatever it is. So what we would do is every single show we went to across the country and across the globe, we would change the music playlist for that specific location and play music from like local artists.
Oh, wow.
Oh, dang.
So like we would, you know, go to Texas and anybody that's from Texas listening to this, you know, probably knows Co Wetzel, who's a Texas music guy. And we'd like play Aaron Watson, who also is an amazing human being. Aaron Watson is another Texas music artist. Mm-hmm. So Aaron Watson, Co Wetzel, like Randy Rogers Band, like all these people, we would get local artists from that area and play the songs and it would all be synchronized perfectly to the show because we've already done the work beforehand, but it really just added that extra layer of connection to the audience. So like, okay, well now they did something really cool. It was on beat with the song, and that song is from my hometown.
Yeah, just like a bunch of elements all adding together for them right. to really leave with that experience.
Yeah, and the goal is they walk away with that experience and they have no idea how much work it went into yeah, doing that, right? Absolutely. Like I want it to be transparent. Like you go to a Cirque du Soleil show and I have no idea how much time they put into that, but it looks effortless.
Right. And it's like a short show, but like you were saying, even when you were playing the missions, same thing. Yeah. Months and months and months for this one thing that's going to go like that. And
yeah, and it looks effortless. And you want, you know, a high level performance, whether it's entertainment or business or whatever it is, like anything high level should look effortless.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you put so much time and effort into it behind the scenes.
Yeah. What's the one thing you wanted to ask about the airplanes?
Oh, okay. So there's this maneuver, right? I've seen it done once. I don't know if you've ever seen this done before. Let me try and find it real quick. Okay. It's very famous. Let me see.
Oh, it was the Cobra where he like stops. Yeah.
Kind of goes up, right? He does something special right now.
Okay. Let me narrate this. He's going up. Okay, he's ejecting. And he's shooting the other plane with a pistol or a bazooka or something crazy. I don't know.
But wait, he's not done yet.
Oh, he gets back in the airplane.
He got back in it.
Okay. Turn the engine back on. It's off to the races.
So
my answer is no, I've never done that.
You never
done And it's also computer generated. not real. But yeah, if you've ever seen that a clip on the internet, it's like literally an F-35. The guy ejects, shoots the other airplane like a bazooka. It climbs back in the airplane. not real.
Well, the game's based in 2042, so it's going to happen later on. You know, that's why. Yeah. It's
you just
like
haven't gotten there
yet. Simulation for the future.
That's when we have like jetpacks. We can just like jetpack ourselves back to the
exactly, area. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. That's amazing. Looking forward to that.
If you made it this far into the episode, that means this podcast was a banger. But we need your help to pick our next guest. So drop a comment down below and let us know who you want to see us interview next.
Pivoting into leadership,
yeah.
Leadership, obviously being in the military, it's a very hierarchical system, right? And leadership is one of the most important things because you would have no order, you would have no efficiency, nothing would function without leadership. So what are some of the most important lessons in leadership that the military taught you?
It's a great question. And I would say, before I kind of go into it, it's not just important for the military.
Yeah.
You know, and you look around and people oftentimes have jobs and they're like, oh, the job's good, I get paid well, whatever it is. But they leave the job because they have a bad boss. That is way more common than just a bad job.
Absolutely.
And I think in the military, we have it's a unique learning environment because we are training for combat, which is a life and death situation. So your margin for error is very small, if there is one at all. And I think in terms of leadership, we have amazing leaders that are officers. We have amazing leaders that are enlisted. And I've learned so many from both, whether the people that were above me, people that were below me in terms of rank, but they were a leader, right, of their organization. They had the traits that you want in a leader. And that kind of goes into, I guess, what I would say is like there are three core traits that we, at least in the Air Force fighter pilot community, think are really important. The first one being humility. And, you know, humility comes in two different flavors, like everything else in life. There's a good and a bad. You know, humility and success means like, hey, you do really well. Are you going to come brag to us how great you are, how smart you are, how you're the best in the world? Like, no, like being humble doesn't mean that you're going to do that. Mm-hmm. Being humble and success means that you're going to take that lesson. How did you succeed? What steps did you take? How did you prepare? And you're going to share that knowledge with us. To make the team get better. So being humble and success is really important. And this is recent, so I'll share it. A really good friend of mine and mentor passed away a little over 2 weeks ago.
No.
He was the best aerobatic pilot in the world. And I'm not saying that because he's my friend and a mentor. Like when you look at the records, he was the best aerobatic pilot in the world. And he was the most humble person you would ever meet in your life. He wore his cargo shorts. He wore his like black Brooks running tennis shoes. Mm-hmm. He wore a t-shirt and a baseball cap or a hoodie. And he was very quiet in the corner. Mm-hmm. He minded his own business. and probably strumming a guitar, playing some Van Halen. And you would never know if you walk into a room that that is the best airbag pilot in the world. And so humility, in my mind, like he exemplified that, where he was the best in the world at his craft. And he never viewed anything as a competition against somebody else. He viewed everything as a competition against himself. How am I getting better compared to what I was before? If you guys want to look him up, you know, people that are listening, Rob Holland, Rob is just an amazing human being. I can't say enough positive things about him. And he was the human embodiment of humility. Just amazing. So humility and success is important. And humility and failure is also important, because we all get humbled at some point.
Absolutely.
There's always somebody bigger, faster, stronger, better than us. And when, or we have a bad day, it happens, you know? And we have those bad days. I think humility and failure simply means that we're open to the idea that we can make mistakes, and that we're open to the idea of learning and getting better. We openly admit our failures and our faults and say, we screwed up here. We made a mistake. But we're going to take feedback from other people that people that we value. We're going to take their feedback and we're going to get better. And we're going to be relentless in our pursuit to get better. So that's how I view humility. The next piece, next kind of trait would be approachability. And that is simply like, do people want to come up to you and talk to you? And why is that important? Well, we need feedback because we're not perfect. There are things we're doing poorly and things we can get better at. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, you're going to do things the way you think they should be done.
Of course.
And until somebody else comes up to you and says, hey, have you thought about this? Have you considered doing it this way? You know, you may not know what that is, but ultimately, if you're a person that's like, I mean, we probably, you know, all of us in school at some point, there's a kid in the back of the class, just like Billy Badass in the back, quiet, arms crossed, right? And you're just like, well, nobody wants to talk to that kid.
Yeah.
Because they're not approachable. Nobody wants to give them feedback. Nobody wants to tell them they're not doing great or they could do better here or wherever, right? So if you're not approachable, you're never open to feedback. You're never able to get better. So that's super important. And the last trait, so humble, approachable, and then the last piece is credible. And credibility comes from doing the work, right? Like being really good at what you do. And what happens when you're really good at what you do? People immediately gravitate towards you, lean on you in times of stress, in times of high pressure to perform. They lean on you for mentorship. They lean on you for all these things. And you become a corner, like a pillar stone or pillar in their organization. So those three traits I think are really important in terms of leadership as a whole. And then one of the biggest traps that I've seen in the military and outside the military for that matter. Oh, by the way, you see people exemplify those traits regardless of rank structure.
Of course.
You know, They're just people that are understand that they buy in and they're amazing. I had 2 senior enlisted members on my team. Master Emmanuel Knowlton, who retired recently, as a senior master sergeant, then Master Sergeant George Fagan. They're my 2 superintendents when I was on the demo team. My right-hand man, and holy cow, amazing human beings, amazing leaders. And I learned so much from them. So I'm incredibly thankful that if I have one talent, it is like finding really good people and bringing in and hiring them on our team. And they were just amazing. So, the other thing I would say is, when you look at pitfalls, when I talk about credibility, you get really good at something. And oftentimes people are really good at their specific thing. But then when they get promoted to like a leadership role, what's natural, right? If let's say somebody's replacing you and you're really good at something and your replacement is not as good as you because they haven't been doing it as long, you want to jump in and fix things, right?
You should do it this way.
How does that feel on the other side of the table? It feels terrible, right? You're like micromanaging and whatever. Mm. So I'd say like in the military specifically, when we get into these very specific jobs and really good at them, we take leadership roles. That's one of the things that I think is kind of a common pitfall that I've seen as an observation. I've done the same thing. Like we've all done it. Like nobody's perfect by any means. And I think, having amazing leaders and mentors, both good and bad, like you have to learn from the good and the bad, has been such an amazing opportunity for me in the military, is just to kind of witness some of the most, competent leaders that you would follow anywhere in the globe. Mm-hmm. One of my squadron commanders in Okinawa, Japan, is a call sign Skid. His name is Scott Rowe. And I've had some amazing leaders. So he's not
by, he's not definitely not the only one, but like he was a guy that could balance being an amazing leader and being so really good in the jet. Like he was just really technically capable and also just an amazing human being as a leader. At least what I found, you know, is like if you're in a leadership role, your job is no longer doing.
Yeah.
Like you don't do the things anymore. You have people to do the things. Your job is to give them a very clear vision of what you want to happen.
Huh.
And you give them the tools to do that, whether it's people, time, money, whatever it is. You find a way to get them the resources they need. And you have to set a culture. You have to set the right culture for your organization. If you're starting an organization, like you have to understand what is the culture I want. And if you are, you know, taking a leadership role from somebody else and joining an organization as a leader, that's even more challenging, I would say, because you have to understand what is the culture that currently exists? Is it the one I want? And who is enforcing it?
I think you bring up a really good point, because let's say you're joining a new culture, and then, like you said, not everyone might accept feedback. Not everyone might be agreeable. So let's say you're joining a new culture. How does a leader come into that?
Yeah. One of the things we do in the fighter pilot world, which I think is kind of funny, it's a fun little thing we do. It's called the 30, 60, 90 day rule. And I won't go through all the specific details, but effectively it means like when you get to a new organization, just like shut up. Don't say anything. Just observe. Learn.
Take it all in.
It's a new organization. They may do things for a very specific reason that you don't know about yet. Mm. So if you go in just guns blazing and trying to like make decisions and changes right away, like you may be counterproductive and you may make those people that are not agreeable even less agreeable. Right? Because you're changing up all things that they're used to. So, you know, kind of initially like take a step back, soak it in, observe, see what the culture is, see who's enforcing that culture, and is it the one you want to have as a leader in the organization. And I don't mean like leaders and like you're the CEO of a company. Like you could be a team leader, you could be whatever level, right? You know, so that's important. And I think to gain buy-in, you have to clearly communicate what is the vision, like what is the why? Like why are we doing this? Why is it important? And why is your job specifically important? When you make that very visible to people, and that's why I said, like when you're a leader, you're not, your job is not to do anymore. Your job is to like to lead the team, which means clearly communicate a vision, establish the culture, and communicate the importance of why you're doing what you're doing and why that matters and why somebody specifically is important in that role. And one of the things that I've heard plenty of times before, and I'm sure you have as well, is like, everybody's important. And you're like, okay, when I say everybody's important, I'm like, they're like rainbows and butterflies flying and like, you know, doves flying and whatever. And it sounds really cool. And I think it's 100% true. I think there's a better way to describe it. And I say, you know, the way I like to describe it is everybody is important at a specific time. Because we go through life as a team, whether it's your family, whether it's your professional life, whatever it is, you go through life as a team and everybody's important at a specific time. So as an example with, you know, the avionics troops that were on the demo team with me, they are probably not the most important person when the air show is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I crash the airplane, that's pretty bad. So for like 20 minutes of the day, I'm the most important person on the team. And then when I'm done with that 20 minutes, I give it back to maintenance and they are the most important people on the team at that time. Because if the jet's broken, I sure can't fix it. I'm not trained for that. They are. They are the most important person on the team at that time. And this kind of rotates, right, in organizations. If, you know, your financials are all messed up, like your CFO and your accounting team probably is the most important person to fix it.
Yeah.
Marketing's not going to do it. Sales isn't going to do it. You know, so you have to figure out who is the most important person on the team and why and when, and then you communicate that to them. So for example, if you have a specific job on a team and you are needed, me as leader, my job is to highlight that and say like, hey, like we are all counting you. This is really important. And you're the only person on the team that can solve this. And we're supportive of you. What can we do to help you accomplish this goal? And then when you crush it, my job is to tell everybody that when it counted, when you were the only person that could solve this problem, you know, we supported you, we helped you, but you figured it out, you supported it. And then you understand immediately, like, okay, the person in charge of my organization supports me, has my back, will give me the resources, time, people, money to accomplish a goal. And they value my contributions to this team. And they explain, like, how do I fit in this overall vision of the organization? Like, why is my specific piece so important?
To illustrate that, like in the airshow world, there were days where, you know, so George Fagan and I drove 15 hours one day to get a part from Florida. We were in South Texas at an air show in South Padre. And this part fails in the airplane, and we drive 15 hours to get a part. The guys who could fix the airplane, like, and oh, by the way, like, I'm in charge of the team, but that was the most useful I could be at the time, because I can't fix the airplane. What's the most useful thing for me to do? Like, get in the truck and start driving. Do this part. Because FedEx and UPS were not going to get there in time. And then the guys who could fix the airplane, like, back at the hotel, getting some sleep, getting some rest. So when we get back, they work out overnight. So they get this thing replaced and fixed, and then we fly the next day. What do you think is the most meaningful way to describe how important that is? What do you think? Like, if you could pick anything, like, if you think about that scenario, okay, I drive with somebody else, pick a part. These guys work overnight to fix this airplane. The most meaningful thing to tell them that everything they just did is worth it is when some 10-year-old little kid sees a jet flying over the air show, smiling ear to ear, looks up their mom and dad and says, I want to do that, or I can do that. Right? Like the vision, the impact of your job is so easily visible.
Yeah.
Right there. So it's up to the leader at that point in whatever organization you're part of to really drill down and figure out, like, why is your job really important and what is the impact? Another example, not related to flying in airplanes, you know, there are a couple friends of mine that own furniture businesses. And, you know, I was talking to some of their employees at one of their stores, and I asked them, I was like, what do you guys do here? You know, it's a furniture store. Well, we sell furniture. Is that what you do? Like, yeah, we sell furniture. I said, well, think about, what does that furniture do? Like, well, it goes to somebody's house. I'm like, you don't sell furniture. You're selling memories. You're creating experiences. If you sell a single mom with two kids a dining room set, that dining room set is now the environment that that single mother and two kids have meals together, share their experiences, share their life, you know, share their days. They create memories. You are selling something that creates lasting memories for families.
Yeah, it's an incredible way to look at it.
You sell a bedroom set. Like, what if two little boys or, you know, brother and sister are sharing a bed because their parents can't afford two beds. And then all of a sudden their family is able to save enough money to buy another bed. Like, what did you just do for that family?
Yeah.
You're not selling furniture. You're selling something way more important. And until your 18-year-old person on the floor that's selling understands that, they're never going to buy in. It's just another job for them. It's transactional. They're there to get a paycheck for their hourly work. They may get some compensation for, you know, their sales.
They're there to sell furniture.
They're just sell furniture.
Yeah, got to really show the impact.
It's a matter of reframing things and making them buy in.
Yeah,
that I guess that indirectly answers my follow up question. It was more of a philosophical question, but obviously we need leaders and we should all practice leadership traits. And we might not be the owner of the business or the CEO, but we can be the leader of our department. But do you think that in order to be the biggest leader, is that something people can grow into, or is that something that requires a special set of personality traits combined with the right skills, combined with the right mindset? What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think the whole idea of like leaders born versus made.
Mm-hmm.
There are some people that are naturally gifted when it comes to leading other people.
Yeah,
you can, and I would say like, you see that in Little League baseball or Little League sports in general. They're always little kids. I mean, I coached 8 to 10 year old baseball for a while, and you always see some kids just naturally, you know, like people are attracted to them because they either play really well or they do something that naturally attracts people to them. So there are people that are naturally, you know, gifted with those personality traits. But to be a good leader, I don't think is like, you're just like either born a good leader or not a good leader. I have countless examples of companies where the leader is an extrovert or the leader is an introvert.
Mm.
You know, so personality type, I don't think really matters. I think understanding yourself is so important because then you can leverage your skills and know, okay, I'm deficient. Like for me, I'll be completely honest. I'm 100% an introvert.
Mm.
Like I would do the air show stuff and I would go talk to thousands of people during the day. I do the shows, talk to them, go to schools, whatever. And I needed to go to the hotel and like just have alone time, just to read a book, listen to a podcast, listen to music, go work out. I just needed like time away from other people. But I know that about myself.
Yeah.
You know, and knowing your strengths, knowing your weaknesses, obviously you're going to make a concerted effort to work on your weaknesses, but understanding where you are in life and who you are as a person is so important, because then you can leverage other people's skills and talents. Like the CEO doesn't have to give like the David Goggins rah-rah speech. Doesn't have to
carry the boats.
Yeah. Who's going to carry the boats, right? Like, you know, it doesn't have to be the CEO.
Yeah.
The CEO can appoint somebody to be that person.
Yeah.
Like every rapper's got a hype man, you know, like, so, you know, it's understanding you as a person, your personality traits, good and bad, and then understanding other people around you. Like, and the only way you understand that is by investing time in them, understanding their pluses and minuses, and how do you use those skills? That's important. And that's a learned skill. I don't think that's a natural, I don't think people are just born with that. Like, you have to go through experiences to learn those skill sets.
Yeah.
And understand, when do I need this? When do I need that? And none of us are born with life, you know, a lifetime of experiences when we're young. So we make mistakes, we fail, we figure out how we can get better. And then we go from there and we just keep doing this over and over again. So to go to be like the head guy of a company or head gal of a company, like you have to go through life experiences. You'll have ups and downs, you'll have laughs and cries, you'll have, you know, strikes and gutters. Like, it's just life. And I think as you build upon those, the real critical piece of that whole puzzle to me is the debrief. Like, every mission we do, we debrief and we go back in painstaking detail and figure out what went wrong. How can you do better? Even if it went like overall went really well, we still find, what are the small details that maybe nobody even saw, like, you know, about, nobody else in the formation knew about, but you're forthcoming, you bring it to light and say, hey, I messed up here, let's look at it. So we go through and debrief. We have a very specific like process that we go through, to make sure it's objective, make sure we're using facts and we're not using emotions. Cause when people make mistakes and you start using emotions, like, it gets bad sometimes, you know? And that's just in everyday life. But I think the debrief is really important, because when you go through, as you're an aspiring leader in an organization, as you go through those life experiences, if you don't take the time to reflect and figure out how I can do better next time, you're wasting that experience. Now you're going to do it again, and you're either going to learn from that time or you're not.
Right.
You know, so I think the debrief piece is so important, because we learn and we grow in that time. But yeah, I guess, you know, there's a long way to answer your question, but I think it's something you learn over time. Some people are just naturally more charismatic, like I mentioned. Some people need to work on it a little more, but it's definitely something you build up over time.
Yeah. I guess the way I was imagining it was more like top down, where the CEO or whoever the leader is at the top, but in a way, in practice, it's more like they're at the center, and they have to make people around them, or hire people around them, that can mold to, like you were saying, where their weaknesses are. Okay, if I'm not the most extroverted person who can give a really good speech, but I know that's what's needed, okay, let me hire somebody that can fill that role for me. Or if I am that person, but maybe I'm not the most organized, let me hire someone that's a really good organizer that's going to make sure everything is where it needs to be. So
yeah,
that definitely makes sense. And in terms of you know, in the military, out of the military, I guess, what are some of the biggest skills that tend to lend themselves towards success? Like, is it diligence? Is it intelligence? Is it teachability? What are some of those traits?
I do think the military gives you a very good baseline of understanding discipline, mm-hmm. understanding processes and procedures. And I think that's so helpful, because really on the discipline side, like, if you don't have discipline, and I don't mean like you have to make your bed every morning. Like, it's not the discipline I'm talking about. The discipline I'm talking about is like, you have a goal, you understand the process to get from where you're at to that goal, and you stick to it, and you stick to a very methodical mm-hmm. process. And you, I mean, you may have to adapt along the way, but like, you understand the end goal and you understand to get there, and you're just going to keep going, no matter what. So I think that discipline is something the military really, you know, added in my life, which I really appreciate. And in terms of, you know, the other qualities, you know, I think, you know, working across diverse teams is important. I said flying airplanes, we don't do it by ourselves. We have a team of maintenance guys. We have, you know, the tankers who have they're like an airborne gas station. Yeah. If we do a long mission, we need the gas. So we have to work with them, you know, and you have to coordinate with all these people and you have different personalities and whatever else. So you're just constantly thrown into situations where you're working with different people. And you have to figure out a way to work together as a team. So the teamwork aspect, the discipline aspect, those are really important. And I think, you know, even from the hierarchical like structure of the military in terms of respect, it's funny. I was in Massachusetts a couple of days ago for my friend's memorial service, and I met somebody. He was older than me, and you know, I said, "Sir," you know, I said, "You know, it's great talking to you, sir." And he's like, "Oh, you don't know me, sir." He was actually enlisted in the Army for a long time, and obviously an officer in the Air Force, you know, and he's like, "You didn't call me, sir." I was like, "One, if my mom were still alive, she would, and she knew I wasn't being respectful to you, she would throw a chunklet at me and it'd be like over with, right?" But I do think, you know, even in the military with people on my team that were enlisted members in the Air Force, I would call them sir all the time.
Of course.
It is never, you know, it is never not cool to be respectful.
Yeah.
Like it's always called for. It's always called for to be respectful. And those understandings of like customs and courtesies within the military and being respectful, I think just carries people a really long way. Because it's something small, but it's unfortunately, it's becoming more and more uncommon.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, I've called people, you know, like younger than me to, you know, thank you, sir, like open doors, whatever it happens to be.
Yeah.
And it's not because I'm trying to be, you know, patronizing or whatever. Like I want to give them respect because I don't know their background. I don't know their story. I don't know where they came from. And based on that, like I have no reason not to say sir to them.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
So I think those are some of the fundamental traits. I think one of the things that the military is bad at in some cases is that you get so used to routine in the military that when you get out and you're like choose your own adventure.
Yeah.
Go this way, go that way. Like I don't have to wake up this time.
There's too much freedom.
I don't have to go to the gym at this time. Like, oh, okay. Like, you know, so you kind of get in some ways it's bad, right? Because you're so used to structure that you kind of crave the structure.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to operate in the gray. You have to be willing to say, well, I don't really know how this is, like, I can't really define this, but shoot, I need to adapt and be flexible here. And there's flexibility and adaptability in the military, which I think people are pretty good at. But in the civilian side, sometimes you get so ingrained with a certain way of thinking that you're not flexible enough to adapt.
Right.
So that's, I guess, one of the downsides of, you know, veterans specifically when they make the transition out of the military. But overall, man, like,
do you have like expectations of other people in your life, maybe, where it's like you expect them to be a little bit more structured because you're so structured?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, I just kind of like, just like,
you know, just like let it go. You're like,
it is. You know, it depends on the situation. You know, if it's like, if it's something important, I think it's really about setting clear expectations. Like, if I need you to be there 5 minutes early, then I need you to be 5 minutes early. Like, you know, and I understand like life happens and whatever else, it's fine. But people that are habitually like, you know, doing things that I'm like, this is not good, then I'll tell them, right? But if it's, and it's also like consequential, right? Like, everything in your life can't be a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's some things that are really important, some things that are like, I'm not going to stress about.
Yeah.
Like, there are way more important things in life to worry about than this one thing. And me getting stressed about something like that's inconsequential, like, all it's going to do is ruin my day. It's not going to make me more productive. It's not going to solve the thing. Like, you know, so it's also understanding, you know, when is appropriate to, like, kind of, you know, I guess, get upset or whatever. Like, you know, like, get worked up about it. Like, sometimes it's just not worth it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we appreciate your time. That was really all the questions we had. Thank you so much for sharing your story, man, from beginning to end. It's really inspiring and really motivational, and we definitely took a lot out of it. Hopefully our audience definitely got a lot out of it. Is there anything else you wish to share with them before we sign off?
I'd say the biggest thing is there is, you know, resilience is so important. No matter what hurdle, no matter what obstacle that you're facing in your life, somebody else has gone through either the same thing or something very similar. And there are always paths past that hurdle, past that obstacle. And I've seen a lot of people that they meet some obstacle and they think they can't overcome it. And truly, it may be uncomfortable. It may be, you know, painful, or maybe some tears, and maybe the whole thing. But everything in your life is something, you know, every challenge is something you can overcome. And more importantly, it's something you can learn from. And it may be something that you went through specifically so you can help teach other people. Mm. And so instead of adopting the mindset of like, poor me, I would just encourage people to think about, how can you like knock this hurdle down and learn from it and share those experiences with other people to make their lives better? So resilience is one of those things that allows us to keep getting through life. And we can't predict life sometimes.
Yeah.
So the mindset thing is so important.
It's huge. It's huge. How can our audience get in touch with you? Where can they find you on social media?
Yeah, absolutely. So on Instagram, at Cabo Gunderson, so CABOGUNDERSON. And then same handle for Instagram, YouTube. I think YouTube's actually Cabo Gunderson 22. Somebody stole my Cabo Gunderson. I'm not sure who that is because I don't think anybody else has named that. Whoever you are, I'm going to find you. I'm just kidding. and then for LinkedIn, it's just my name, Joshua Gunderson. So those are kind of the platforms I'm working on right now. But yeah, feel free to reach out, connect, send questions. Happy to answer any questions you may have. And then also website, www.cabogunderson.com.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much for joining us. Guys, thank you guys so much for all the support you guys have been showing on the recent episodes. We hope you guys enjoy this one. Go ahead and find all our social media links in the description. We'll see you guys next week for another episode, man. Peace.